Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the evolution of lowrider culture. And want to attend the wedding of people you don't know, but not as a wedding crasher? A new service can help with that. But first, it's time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
You now have an entire united Republican caucus in both the House and the Senate, and we are going to be very insistent on keeping 95%, if not 99%, of this package intact.
This budget cuts our health care by $126 million, one of the biggest cuts to health care in state history.
Mr. Secretary, this war is stuck. The Strait of Hormuz is closed. The Iranian regime is in place. The nuclear material still in their hands. Americans are being crushed by higher costs.
Close to schools, in the middle of a community that was never asked and never consented.
They felt like they had some kind of a legal right to this very sensitive information of yours. And I said no again, and that lawsuit from the Department of Justice has been dismissed. That means we won.
I'm looking forward to the conclusion of this investigation, which I know will show what reporting has confirmed, that I was not involved in the decision, and that DCS acted in the best interests of Arizona's foster children.
And joining me to talk about the GOP budget starting to move through the legislature, the potential impact on Arizona's congressional lines of a new U.S. Supreme Court ruling, and more, our former state lawmaker, Regina Kopp. Regina, good morning.
Good morning.
And attorney Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Regina, you are a former chair of a legislative appropriations committee, so it's fortuitous that you are here this week. We heard just a moment ago from State Representative Matt Gress, who says that Republicans are going to insist on at least 90, maybe, you know, 95 to 98% of what's in their budget in the final version. Is he going to get his wish?
I don't think so. And I think they're going to be here till the end of June if he really feels that way. Matt's been in that room with me when he was working for Governor Ducey. He knows what it takes. It takes people to sit in a room and actually negotiate. And they haven't done that. Governor Hobbs put out her budget, refused to, you know, meet with them. Then that now they put their budget out. Neither side has come in and decided that they're going to negotiate. And until they do, they're not going to get a budget.
What do you think of this process where the governor obviously is required to release their budget at the beginning of January? But since then, there have been apparently some negotiations. The governor walked away from it and said the Republicans need to show the public what their plan is instead of just saying they hate mine. Republicans took a few weeks and then put forward their plan and now said, OK, we're waiting for the governor to call us.
Yeah, I think this process is crazy. What we've started with usually during the summertime was with agencies, and then you start at the beginning of the year when the legislative process starts, and you start negotiating then. Usually you walk into a room and there's about 70 to 80% that both sides agree on. Then you get that out of the way, and then you find out what your go-home issue is. Hers is Prop 123. They know that. So when they're saying 99% of the budget, Prop 123 isn't in this. This is her go-home thing. Theirs is conformity, and they have that complete conformity in there. She's willing to negotiate a little bit on that direction. I think not complete conformity, but most of it. I think they just have to sit in a room and figure out what else can they agree on before they get to those two points.
Roy, does it seem like they're capable of doing that at this point, the two sides?
I'm going to try to be optimistic today. I mean, I think there's obviously a lot of posturing going on by both sides, and that's, you know, led to the situation that we're in. Both sides have priorities. I think both sides have, you know, some red lines. I mean, so for example, I think the Republicans have said that ESA reform is something that they're just not willing to do, mm-hmm. Which is obviously something that the governor's asking for. Similarly, on the other side, this Republican budget has deep cuts to Medicaid and to SNAP and other things that the governor's already vetoed. So, you know, I don't think that's going to get in. But I totally agree with Regina that, like, there's going to have to be compromise here. I mean, I think one Republican said earlier this week that well, we don't need any Democratic votes. Well, you need the biggest and most important Democratic vote of all, which is the governor's signature, right? So obviously there's going to need to be some compromise. I'm optimistic in that, you know, these folks don't want to be there until the end of June because it's an election year in particular.
And the primary is just a couple weeks after that.
And the primary is coming. And, you know, so voting will have already begun at that point and all of that. And so maybe that puts some downward pressure. But everybody's going to have to give up something ultimately because we're in an era of divided government.
What do you make of the fact that the Republican budget had almost across the board 5% agency cuts? It excluded a few public safety ones. But is that something you think the governor is going to go along with?
Well, we're obviously in a difficult fiscal situation. I mean, you know, it's a lot easier to do a budget when you have a surplus. And here, you know, because of the overall economic, you know, slowdown and things like that, we have a fiscal deficit. And so there's always going to be cuts in that scenario, across the board cuts, whether that makes sense or not. You know, I'm not sure that will make sense to the governor. Again, conformity issue is a big issue here. I think the governor has indicated that she likes some of the cuts, particularly the ones that are, you know, for middle class Arizonans. So, you know, there's compromise that's going to be there. But again, everyone's going to have to give up a little bit of what they want to get this done.
Regina, you mentioned Prop 123 being a big thing for the governor. This is something that the legislature and governor have been trying for at least 2 years now to renew. It expired last year. Would you have optimism that in the next X number of weeks they can do what they've not been able to do in the last couple of years?
When the pressure's on, you can do anything. And what they haven't done over the last couple of years is really tried. I think what they did is do a lot of posturing. As he said, it was, you know, they're both been posturing on both sides. It could be done, and I think it could be a continuation of what we do right now, or it could be cut down to 5.9. I think the Republicans could go for those kind of – if it was reduced a little bit, I think they could. They're concerned about the corpus of it, and I think
the state land trust.
And they should be. If they keep it at it where it's at or below, I think they'll be fine. But they've got to negotiate that. So I think they can do it. And the pressure is they've got to get out of there so they can all go back and run for reelection.
Is this the kind of situation, Regina, where the past, like especially the budget under Governor Hobbs' first year, where people refer to it as the Oprah budget, where everybody gets a certain amount of money and can do what they want. I wonder if that in some ways hurts the negotiations now because they don't kind of have that muscle memory of having 3 years worth of Republican legislative leaders and the governor really negotiating a budget. Like they've done different stuff over the couple of years and they've not really had to do one like this.
You're correct on that. The muscle memory is gone for the last 3 years, which really does put them at a disadvantage. But you have your leaders who have done this before. They know how to go back to that again. You have got Kavanaugh, Peterson. Peterson sat right beside me most of the negotiations, mm-hmm. I think, in 23. And then you have Matt Gress, who's been in there for all 8 years, pretty much, that Ducey was in there.
David Livingston's been there a long time,
yeah.
too. I mean, Kavanaugh's been there almost forever.
He was my vice chairman for 4 years.
Yeah.
And he was in the room with me the whole time.
Does that experience, Roy, like come into play, especially right now when, as you say, sort of the time pressure is on and, you know, there are clearly some pretty significant differences between the governor and the legislature. Does having that experience in the room matter?
I think it absolutely has to matter. But the other thing that happens here, and I think legislators have been guilty of this for a very long time here in Arizona, is that you don't really have the Republicans negotiating with the Democrats in the legislature, really. I mean, the Democratic caucus is not really, you know, to my understanding, been particularly involved in negotiating directly with the Republican caucus. That also leads to delays because, you know, again, everybody's got to look at it.
But that's not anything new.
No,
it's been
not.
Like that for a long time.
So in a perfect world, though, things like that would happen.
So you're saying the legislature is an imperfect world. Right?
That's what I'm saying, unfortunately. And I don't know if it will change. But, you know, just thinking about sort of practicalities of this is why we are at, you know, kind of stalemate points like this and why we run the risk of going until June.
But couldn't one make the argument that sort of the governor is negotiating on behalf of the Democratic caucuses? And in theory, anyway, the Democrats in the legislature are communicating with the governor or her staff and saying, OK, we need A, B and C. We're not doing X, Y and Z. And that is sort of taken into consideration when the governor and the legislature eventually start talking about this?
In theory, that's true, although every legislator, I'm sure, and Regina is a true expert at this, but every legislature is going to have priorities that are specific to their district that they have to care about, which may be a little bit different. But again, also the question becomes, do you really want to have a bipartisan budget? I think we all should strive for that. Obviously, it doesn't always happen, but that all involves negotiations with everybody.
And when you're talking about experience, I mean, Governor Hobbs doesn't have the experience that some of the other legislators have in there. And I think that you ask somebody without experience to be your negotiator, that's not a good thing. This year, they've decided they're going to do what they call the super cage, which means that they have the full appropriations committee on both sides in the room. You have that many people in the room, you are not going to come up with a good balance, I don't think. I think that's a difficult thing. You just need the experience in the room to be in the room and doing the job.
Is that a matter of like too many cooks in the kitchen?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely too many cooks in the kitchen.
All right. So, guys, let's just a couple minutes until the break. I want to ask you about a federal judge this week decided that a lawsuit that the Federal Department of Justice filed against Arizona was to be thrown out. This is the one that asked for voter information from Arizona voters. They purportedly wanted to use it to make sure that Arizona is following law in terms of keeping the voter rolls maintained and all that sort of thing. Roy, this is an area that you work in quite a bit. Is this – like are you surprised that a Trump-appointed federal judge tossed this lawsuit out?
I'm not surprised. And for full disclosure, I filed on behalf of a client an amicus brief on the side of the Secretary of State in the litigation. I'm not surprised at all. And if you look across the country, I think I count six different states that have, you know, been sued by the Department of Justice or sued the Department of Justice related to this request. In all six of those states, the Department of Justice has lost. So they're obviously not making the case, legally speaking, on why they should be entitled to this kind of information. This is very sensitive, personal data that they would be turning over to the Department of Justice. And so I think the Secretary of State needs to be given credit for fighting back and winning this lawsuit. So it doesn't surprise me. It was Judge Brnovich on the federal court. She's a very considerate judge, knows this law very well. And so I'm not surprised that she came out this way.
Do you have a sense of whether DOJ may or may not appeal this?
It's hard to say. I mean, my theory on why they want this data, because it hasn't really been explained very well by the Department of Justice, is that we have a president that still is an election denier. In other words, he still doesn't believe that he lost the 2020 presidential election. And I think you have a Department of Justice that's doing his bidding to basically show to him that they're doing something about it, and that something is trying to gather data to build up a case on why there was fraud. Because again, we have not seen any evidence of fraud thus far in the countless lawsuits we've had since 2020. But I think that's the reason why they're doing it. And if that's the reason, then yeah, they will likely appeal.
Regina, what do you make of this ruling and sort of what it means for Arizona voters and Arizona elections?
Well, I think that it's a lot of chatter that we shouldn't be dealing with right now. It's something that has been just what Roy said. It's been something that, we want to say we're doing something. And so we are doing it. I think there's other things with the elections that you could do and ways to make it safer. Going back and doing voter rolls, I have a mixed feeling about this. I want to make sure they're correct, but do I want to give my personal information all the way to the federal government and they know everything about me? I know they know a lot already, but I mean, this is one more step of giving my personal information out.
Sure. Roy, let me start with you on a big ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court that could have implications for Arizona, dealing with a congressional map in Louisiana, basically saying that there was a district that was unconstitutionally racially gerrymandered. The president of the Arizona Senate, Warren Peterson, has said Republicans here will file a lawsuit to try to undo some districts here that he considers to be unconstitutional as well. Obviously, Arizona has an independent redistricting commission, so it's a slightly different procedure than in a lot of other states. But could Arizona's congressional maps end up changing before the next census when they would be changed anyway?
So without running the risk of being the worst guest that you could have on here, I'm a bit limited on what I can say on this topic, given the fact that I was the co-lead counsel for the redistricting commission this time around. And theoretically, if Peterson proceeds with anything, I would imagine, that's going to involve the commission. So I don't want to, talk about necessarily what the Supreme Court decision means for redistricting going forward. I will say, and I think we all know this, that the state constitution has a number of factors that the commission has to consider when it draws its maps. It has a process that the commission must follow. I think that this commission followed that process and considered all those factors appropriately. And I think the evidence for that, quite frankly, is the fact that no one really sued the commission's maps after they were promulgated, unlike 2000, unlike 2010. So to me, that's a sign that the commission did its job well. You know, obviously, if President Peterson, you know, intends to move forward in challenging the maps, I'll respond to anything that he asserts on behalf of the commission at the direction of the commission, and we'll go from there.
Were you surprised that at the reasoning that the U.S. Supreme Court gave in its decision out of Louisiana?
Not really. I mean, just talking very generally speaking, this seems along the lines of what this, you know, Chief Justice Roberts-led court has been doing in this area. I mean, there's been a number of decisions now involving the Voting Rights Act that they have done. And I think most observers of the court were not particularly surprised that this is the way that it came out, when you had the six, you know, conservative justices on one side and the three liberal justices on the other. So in that sense, I'm not surprised. And it's sort of the trend that we have been seeing from this court.
Regina, Arizona has been immune from the redistricting battles that we've seen play out over the country after President Trump urged Texas to start redrawing. That, of course, set off this domino effect. Could this be what changes that? Not for necessarily for 2026, because as we've talked about, the midterms are very close and the primaries are very close. And, you know, this would have to go through court. But in terms of maybe 2028 or sometime before the next redistricting would have ordinarily happened?
Well, the normal redistricting would happen in 2030.
Yeah. After the census.
We're going to be two years earlier. So there's a lot of things to consider here. Are we going to start doing midterm redistricting or middle of the 10-year decade redistricting that we do? It takes us over a year to do redistricting. And as Roy said, this one was pretty good. I think they did a pretty decent job. This could boomerang on the Republicans. And I hope that they look at this as something to a warning, because we could actually have redistricting that causes a whole state to go blue.
Really? You think that?
There could be, yeah. And honestly, it's or you could do it to where you put all of the Republicans into one district, and then Democrats you've got a competitive district and other districts. So it could boomerang on us. So I feel like that we should leave it as is every 10 years, do the job. There's a lot of processes that we need to go through with redistricting that couldn't be done in a very short amount of time.
If you are Senate President Peterson, like, how concerned would you be that, as you say, like, this could come back and maybe create more competitive districts, or maybe even more like lean Democratic districts?
Yeah, I would be concerned about that. I think you got to look at both sides. You got to have your eyes open when you look at this. It can't just be that a Republican, we want to just change everything to Republicans. It would be nice to do that, but you can't do that. But here we are saying that this state, we want to change it for this state. Well, it could happen in another state going the other direction.
Interesting. So, guys, late last week, the attorney general filed a lawsuit to try to stop the ICE detention warehouse facility that's being built in Surprise. And she had gone through sort of a litany of reasons. There was a stop work order on that anyway. But Roy, I'm curious what you make of the fact that the attorney general is going to court now to try to stop this facility, which at least some in the community don't necessarily want. And the city council has basically said, look, even if we don't want it, there's nothing we can do to stop it. It seems like Mays is saying, well, this is something we can do to stop it if that's what the goal is.
I think that's right. I mean, she's challenging this on the grounds that they didn't do the appropriate environmental impact study at that location. And this has been the type of challenge that we've also seen in other states. And we've seen at least one judge in another state agree with the plaintiff in that case that the federal government has not done the appropriate environmental impact study. So that is the legal claim, I think. But obviously, the larger point here is, and I think Attorney General Mays said this in the lead up clip that you played, which is that, you know, this would be in a community of Surprise where folks in the community don't want this facility there. And they obviously didn't have a say in putting it there. And so, you know, I view this as her fighting back on behalf of that community to make sure that this facility is in place there. And if that means, you know, going to court and you know, claiming that they didn't file, an environmental impact study, then that's what you got to do in order to do that.
Regina, we should mention that, like, it's not uniform. Like, not everybody in Surprise is opposed to this. Not, you know, not everybody in any place will be for or against. against anything. Obviously, there's a, you know, a spectrum of opinions here. But from a, I guess, from sort of a political standpoint, Attorney General Mays is obviously running for re-election this year. She has not been shy about going after the Trump administration. Is this, do you see this as, in addition to the legal, you know, the legal issues that she clearly sees with this, savvy political move on her part or not?
I think it's futile. I think that she is doing politicking. And I think that calling it a nuisance law and saying they didn't go through the environmental impact study, I think it's going to be it's not going to go anywhere. There are many communities that don't want like prisons in their communities, but they end up with a prison in their community. So I think that you just it's not something. I think she's just doing politics.
Could the administration have done even like a cursory, I don't know, like an online survey or something in Surprise, just so folks there felt like they at least had some kind of say in this? Or do you think they made the right choice just by saying we're doing it here and we don't like we're not looking for opinions on this?
I think that if they wanted to get it done, they did it the way they did it, and they should have done it the way they did it. Because if you start going out for public comment, you're going to get exactly what you said. You're going to get both sides out there fighting, and it's going to be a delayed response. So if they wanted to get it done as quickly as they did it the way they should have done it.
Okay. So, guys, a couple of minutes left. Regina, I want to ask you about the newest state lawmaker, member of the House, someone that you had served with. Sylvia Allen was appointed by the Navajo County Board of Supervisors to replace David Marshall, who was appointed maybe legally, to be the Navajo County recorder. She has obviously experience. She served in the legislature for a while and is coming in at a time when I would imagine having been there before is pretty valuable.
Absolutely. I think this is the perfect choice for them. It was kind of like when Steve Parrish came in the Prescott area when they needed somebody to come in and fill in a spot, especially in towards the end of session, right before an election. She's not running for reelection. So this is a perfect person to be in there. Sylvia is a great legislator, did a great job when she was in there. I could see her coming in with her experience and being able to jump right into all the budget negotiations, all of the final bills that are being presented at this point.
Roy, I would not anticipate that you and and now Representative Allen would share a lot of political beliefs. But in terms of having the experience of having been a legislator at a time when you're coming in and voting on a budget, is there value there?
I mean, we don't share a lot of beliefs.
Maybe not any.
Maybe some, but certainly not on how old the Earth is, for example, or something like that. But but yeah, I mean, she's going to be there. To Regina's point, she's going to be there for just the remainder of this session. You have somebody in there that's done this before. I don't really see any long term impact that's going to have because she's not going to be running for re-election or anything like that. And so having somebody that's done it is not a bad idea.
And presumably she will vote in the same way that her predecessor would have, right? So you're not there's no real change there other than the human sitting in the chair.
No, that's exactly right. And we're at sort of towards the end game of this budget negotiation.
We just jinxed it.
And so I don't think it's going to make much of a difference.
Would you agree with that, Regina? Like,
yes.
She and Representative Marshall would have voted the same way.
They would have voted the same way. And I think that Sylvia is a strong woman and she'll finish out this season good with it.
All right. Terrific. Thank you guys for the conversation. Regina Cobb, Roy Herrera, good to see you both. Thank you.
Good to see you too. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, ever wish you could go to a stranger's wedding? Well, there's a website that can make your wedding crashing dreams a reality. But first, the Phoenix Suns season ended earlier this week with a 4-game sweep against the defending NBA champion Oklahoma City Thunder. The Suns had made it into the playoffs as the 8th seed by beating the Golden State Warriors in the play-in tournament. That followed a season in which the Suns largely defied expectations and won 45 games. That's 9 more wins than they had last season and more than most prognosticators expected them to have this season. With me now to review this past season and look ahead to the future is Dana Scott, sports reporter for the Arizona Republic. Dana, good morning.
Good morning.
So how big of a surprise in the NBA world were the Suns this season?
Yeah, it was a great surprise because everybody thought that they would only get to 36 games, match their total last year where they didn't make the playoffs for the first time in 5 years since the 2020 bubble. Or actually, it's a 2021 is when they went to the finals.
Yeah.
And 2020 is when they barely missed it on a shot that was missed by Caris LeVert, then of the Brooklyn Nets. Everyone in Phoenix was on the edge of their seat hoping he'd make that shot for the Suns to get pulled in when they went on that 8-0 run in the bubble, which was improbable for them at the time, and they hadn't made the playoffs in 10 years at that time. But then the Suns, of course, 5 years after that, were considered one of the best teams in the league as they made trades for Chris Paul and then had him for 3 seasons until they traded him off for Bradley Beal and then basically traded the farm for Kevin Durant. And the basically the championship expectations were there with that former big three of Kevin Durant and Bradley Beal and Devin Booker building around him. And then they had to rebuild around Booker again for the season, and they were expecting the team to basically just be in the basement of the Western Conference, which was really loaded. So no one expected rookie coach Jordan Ott to come in, a rookie head coach to come in from the Cleveland Cavaliers and being the offensive coordinator of the league's, the Eastern Conference's best record last year, to just turn this team around so quickly.
Well, so how much of the turnaround do you think was the coach and maybe his staff? How much of it was the players? Maybe how much of it was the players who weren't there this year that had been there, you know, the last year or two?
Well, they had to get younger, for one. They had to get rid of a lot of guys. Also being the second apron yet last year with Bradley Beal's contract.
In terms of the luxury tax, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Luxury tax and into the second apron, where they can only get veteran minimum guys, where Bradley Beal, Kevin Durant, and Devin Booker were worth $150 million, just the three of them alone, or among them. And then everybody else was, they couldn't get anybody beyond a veteran minimum contract per the collective bargaining agreement. And so now that after having to eat the expensive sandwich that they bought with trading for Bradley Beal for basically $250 million from his Washington Wizards contract that they traded for with that no trade clause. They had to buy him out and get him to waive his no trade clause in order to put him against the cap for 5 years and put them under the first apron, so that way they could go out and sign guys and get Colin Gillespie on a guaranteed deal for their starting point guard, and then get trade Kevin Durant to get Dylan Brooks and Jalen Green, who became basically their big three with Devin Booker, and that trade for to Houston to get them and create that nucleus, and then get other guys, of course, re-sign. Get Royce O'Neal, of course, on an extension. Grayson Allen was on $18 million. And then, to have those guys really buy into Jordan's system, which was offensive rebounding and improving that, improving the defense and extending possessions, and as well as the three-point shooting, that's really where the Suns hung their hat this season.
Mm. Okay, so looking ahead, you mentioned how the Suns sort of traded the farm to get Kevin Durant. A big part of that was a lot of first-round draft picks. So looking ahead to next season, what changes would you expect to see? Because obviously it's great that they defied expectations, made the playoffs, but I assume that, you know, the ownership and the coaching staff and the players don't want to make the playoffs and get swept in the first round every year. So what are they? What can they do? What do they need to do to get better?
Well, what they need to do is continue to improve their defensive rating. They saw a big jump in that. They went from 27th in defensive rating last year to 9th this season. Mm. Also, they made a big jump from last year at 26th in offensive rebounding percentage and got to 13th. And also, they were in a three-way tie for scoring with the Magic and 76ers at 13th to 21st, from 21st the year before. So what they need to continue doing is having that rim protection, also get healthier, because Mark Williams' knee, the third foot metatarsal injury, has really plagued him this season, and that's been that the rim protection, because they were dead last in rim protection last year. That's helped them and with his percentage when he's out there on the floor, as well as they need to continue to have the playmaking of Osa Iguodaro, who's basically their Swiss Army knife as a big, as 6'10". But at the same time, as they need to get some more inside play, because they didn't have Mark Williams all series against the OKC Thunder, who have the best defensive team, historically one of the best of all time. And so that's where they're going to need to get to if they're going to have to compete with the OKCs, the San Antonio Spurs, or even teams like the Timberwolves. And they've had some big wins this season against the Thunder and Spurs and Timberwolves too. So they're going to continue to need to have that inside play to establish them to higher percentage shots.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Dana Scott with the Arizona Republic. Dana, thanks for your insights. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. For our next segment this morning, we'd like to introduce you to Jeff and Karina Besson. They're a San Diego couple that came up with a way for you to attend a wedding even if you're not on the guest list. Why? Well, the Bessons got married young when most of their friends weren't ready to settle down. And by the time they were, Jeff and Karina already had a family and little kids, and getting out to weddings was a lot harder. So they came up with a way they could go to more weddings, and you can too. It's called Not a Wedding Crasher, where they allow couples to invite strangers to their weddings. Might sound a little nuts, but there are some real reasons for this. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with them more about it, beginning with the genesis of this idea.
We were literally sitting one day, and Jeff said, "Hey, don't you wish we could go to more weddings?"
Yeah.
And I was like, "Yeah, I mean, that sounds like fun, but we don't know people getting married, especially at our age now." And that's kind of where it was born. Jeff was like, "Hey, what if we could go to weddings and not know the couple?
I just want to go," right?
Yeah. And there's no way to do that, right? It is atypical, I guess, in society to some extent, but people love experiences. And we said, we had an idea and let's do something with it.
Yeah. Okay. So you started this site. How does this work? Like, you can basically purchase a spot, a seat at a wedding and participate as if you were an invited guest from the beginning?
Yeah. So we formally launched a month ago. So this is still very, very new.
Yeah.
And there's already been over 300 guests that have already signed up that have interest in attending weddings. And we have 6 weddings that are live right now.
Wow.
So the way the process goes is that let's just say that a couple has already listed their wedding on our website. A guest would go on, they would create a profile, and they would hopefully find a wedding that we have on our platform in their area. Mm-hmm. Now, let's just take one that's outside of Phoenix, which is happening on, I believe, May 3rd. Someone would go on as a guest, and they would request a seat at that wedding. And every guest that is on the platform, when they request a seat, they have to verify their identity to say who they are. So they have to scan their IDs and they have to do a biometric scanning to ensure they are the person that they are.
Sure.
That's one level of trust that we're creating on this platform. So trust and security are huge, especially for a couple that is having their special day. The couple that listed their wedding sets what I'll call a contribution amount. So there's a monetary contribution amount, which is similar to having a price per seat. And they set it based upon what they likely put in as a cost to their wedding and what they think the value is for their wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So a guest would go on, they would request a seat, they put a message in there. Okay. The request would get sent to the couple, and they have the ultimate approval decisions on who they would like to attend their wedding. And when the wedding occurs, they show up.
They show up and follow the rules and wear the right things and all that kind of stuff, I'm sure, yes.
It kind of runs like any other ticket you would buy to an event.
So that's the kind of the guest side of it, the people who might want to attend a wedding. And I can totally understand that. Yeah, like my friends are all kind of past the age of getting married and I want to go to more weddings, right? I would love that. But what about the people who are listing their weddings? What are their motivations?
Yeah, so the value proposition to a couple is offsetting some of their costs. Weddings are very expensive. Right now, the average cost of a wedding in the United States is $36,000, which is a big number for anybody. People cancel last minute, or maybe a couple wants a venue that has a seat minimum, mm-hmm. and they can't meet a seat minimum.
Okay, I can understand that. Sure.
Yeah. The other aspects, which are probably a bit more social, is that having extra seats or open seats at a wedding don't look great in pictures. There's less energy at the wedding. There's less, I'll say, vibe or good vibe. So there's like that feel good type of piece or element to this that a couple wants as well.
I mean, obviously we live in a world of social media, right? Where the pictures and the videos from the wedding are kind of everything. Is that part of it? Do you hear from couples about that?
Yeah, I would say for sure. I mean, I don't want to say like they want to have like this social media focused wedding, but yeah, I mean, when people are getting married and this is one of the most important milestones of their life, they want to have very good memories of that.
So have you ever done this, you two? Have you been seat fillers at a wedding?
Yeah, actually, was it 2 weeks ago? We actually went to a wedding and it was in San Diego County, up in the mountains.
We actually had another couple also attend.
So did you have fun?
It was incredible. We got to line dance and we got to, the ceremony was involved and we got to listen to their vows and be a part of such a special, loving experience. And then followed up, it was a giant party. It was great. There was an open bar. They had people teaching you different dances.
Photo booth. I mean,
we got to socialize with a ton of amazing people. Hmm. It was truly, truly an incredible experience.
So not weird to be at a stranger's wedding. It turned out to be really fun, it sounds like.
It actually felt so much more natural than I think people could predict.
So, I mean, I wonder this because you're obviously thinking a lot about this as you're watching who's signing up as guests, who's offering up their weddings, like you're trying to get the word out there about this new service. Like, you know, what do you think this says about the wedding industry as a whole? Like, do you think this says anything about how much we value, you know, the appearance versus the experience or how maybe open we are on the other side?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a combination of the experience and open side of things. I think we're in a world now, especially as we're kind of getting past the thick of COVID, if you will, where people want to experience new things. People are open-minded, both on the guests and the couple side. Just to give you a little insight on the guests that we're seeing on the platform, they can range anywhere. And I should mention, everyone is required to be at least 21 years old. Mm-hmm. There could be alcohol involved. So anywhere from people from 21 years old to 70s and 80s year old, couples, singles, all sorts of people. What I found interesting actually is people that are in the wedding industry that work in the wedding industry actually have signed up, a lot of them, because they're always working at weddings and they don't have an opportunity to actually sit back and enjoy them.
They want to go.
Also,
that's so funny.
People getting married, it's a very great way to go experience a wedding, potentially get some ideas.
Mm, not a bad call. Do you get some singles who maybe want to go and meet somebody at a wedding?
Yes, very much so. I mean, people on social media comment and say this is a great way to meet other people.
Yeah, I guess that makes
sometimes
sense.
Sometimes it's just a group of friends, you know, like two friends that are like, hey, me and my friend really want to go.
Yeah, well, it sounds like fun. Weddings are a blast. Absolutely.
They really are. They really are.
Well, that is Jeff and Karina Besson, the founders of Not a Wedding Crasher. Jeff, Karina, thank you so much for coming on. This is really interesting.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
And if you want to attend a wedding yourself via Not a Wedding Crasher, you can sign up for RNB's wedding they mentioned. It's being hosted in Gilbert this Sunday. Check out our website for more. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Remember to sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. While you're online, you might as well follow us on Instagram as well. We are at KJZZ The Show. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Claire Lawton, our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is the news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.